you now have the floor.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Harley and Dan, for the invitation. It's great to hear a lot of familiar voices, familiar names, and folks that I hope to meet in the future as well. I'm Jim Bell. I'm a professor at ASU, president of the Planetary Society, and planetary scientist, working actively on opportunity and curiosity, mostly, and prepping for Mars 2020. Kind of a camera guy, interested in surface composition and mineralogy from multispectral imaging and spectroscopy. And today I'm going to give kind of an updated version of a talk that I gave for a panel that was at the H2M conference back in the spring. And it's relevant to the topics that this group talks about. Just throwing some ideas out there, maybe some reminders, and probably more questions than answers about how some of the things that we do and experiences we've had in the robotic exploration world are relevant and interesting for future study, thinking about telerobotics from Mars orbit. So that's kind of introduction on slide one. And if we just jump to slide two, you know, here's the squid chart. I guess probably none of us can give talks these days without showing the squid chart, right? And just point out that, you know, the ultimate discussion has to do with the bottom right there, thinking about getting people out there to Mars orbit, Martian moons, eventually down to the surface. But it's, I believe, a very relevant digression to talk about the experience from orbiters, and especially today I'll talk about landed vehicles, rovers, as input into some lessons learned and some planning, strategic planning ideas for thinking about getting to Mars orbit. So slide three, give you my bottom lines up front, and I'll come back to each of these points throughout. I'm a robotic exploration guy, but I give a lot of public talks and professional talks, and I try to beat the drum that robotic exploration is human exploration. And I'll explain in more detail what I mean by that. Number two, that robotic exploration enables both science and human exploration. And I think most people on this line are probably aware of that, but I'll go through some of my examples and justifications in a little bit of detail. And then three, thinking about the issue of latency. Of course, it's one that we struggle with mightily in the robotic world. Typical latencies of, you know, 24 to 48 to 72 hours. It's a complex issue though, because, you know, despite that latency, we have been able to achieve an enormous amount from the scientific and exploration perspective. And it's a complex issue then, thinking about what is it that will drive us towards optimizing very low latency situations, either from orbit or ultimately from the surface with direct human exploration. So it's a complex issue, and we really do need to study it carefully as a community, and that activity is ongoing, I know. And I'll try to point out, maybe hopefully successfully, some of the lessons from the robotic world that can help to inform that study. Okay, slide four, probably too fuzzy to read, but it doesn't matter. The point is a visual one, and that is that, and this is a chart from the Planetary Society, and that point is there's been just an enormous, successful, exciting, dramatic history of international exploration of Mars with robotic vehicles. you know, I think most of the folks on this line know that. And those include a number of very successful surface missions, including Opportunity, which is still active today, and Curiosity, also very active today. In fact, today is Sol 4,481 of Opportunity's 90-day mission on Mars, so that's pretty cool. And Curiosity is at 1,447. So we've got a lot of experience from the surface and a lot of experience from orbit, active orbiters there, Odyssey, Mars Express, MRO, Maven. I think that the robotic community has a lot to potentially contribute to this conversation. Go to slide five. the drivers for what we're doing on the surface and from orbit are many, and include many of the same drivers that are going to drive human exploration to the red planet, astrobiology being, prominent among them, going back to the first surface mission, Viking, and Carl Sagan's advocacy of searching for life and searching for evidence of habitable environments really was the driver for that that particular mission, and in a sense has been a constant driver for Mars exploration as well as other parts of planetary science since then. Slide six is just highlights, I'll highlight this many times, the role of mobility has been absolutely critical in our understanding of, in our developing understanding of the surface of Mars. And that started really with Pathfinder in 97, demonstrating in a very modest way, the value of being able to carry a sensitive instrument, in this case, an APXS for elemental composition, the value of being able to carry an instrument and make, which at the time was the first elemental chemistry measurement of rocks on Mars, something Viking wasn't able to do, wasn't able to reach and interrogate the rocks directly. So mobility has been now for 20 years just an absolutely critical aspect of surface exploration with robotic vehicles, and of course it's going to be absolutely critical for human exploration as it is in field geology on the Earth. Slide seven is intended to sort of highlight visually the role that the orbiters play is giving us a global geologic context for the first time. So, we go and we play with Google Earth and we can see our neighborhood and we can look at the local topography and we can look at maps of urban heat islands and all that, and we have this spectacular data set for the Earth. Well, it turns out we have a spectacular data set for Mars as well, detailed global topography, geology, mineralogy, all of the kind of key data sets that are needed to figure out where to land these robotic assets in landing site studies that have been going on since Pathfinder, including the one that's going on right now for 2020. All those data sets coming from this spectacular family of orbiters that have been there sort of nonstop since the mid-90s, and then, of course, the Mariner and the Viking series as well before that. So getting that global geologic context has been absolutely critical for landing site selection for rovers. It's going to be absolutely critical for landing site selection for human exploration as well. And Rick and others know there's already been starting activities beginning to think about how to fold in these kinds of robotic data sets into decisions about human exploration zones and where to send people. So that's a really important aspect of this. Slide eight is intended to highlight a lot of what drives the specific choices of instrumentation and investigations is not facility kinds of decisions by NASA or other space agencies, but community decisions, community competitions based on standards and goals set out by groups like MEPAG, documents like the Planetary Decadal Survey, et cetera, NASA science goals, et cetera. And that leads to competitions among scientists like myself and others to do PI, principal investigator-led science. And so I try to always remind people, and it's often entertaining when I give public talks, that that what we're doing on Mars is much more than just taking a lot of pretty pictures. We certainly do that, but here it's highlighting what I call the squiggly line science: infrared spectroscopy, elemental chemistry, mineralogy, visible near-infrared spectroscopy. A lot of the science, the detailed scientific results that come out about habitability, about the early environment of Mars, about the current environment of Mars, come from these kinds of PI-led science investigations. And we're able to do it very successfully robotically. And these particular kinds of measurements, many of them lend themselves to the kinds of long latency missions we've been doing robotically. But I can easily imagine that an extrapolation to the future that many of these same kinds of instruments could be optimized for use by astronauts on the surface or in orbit as well. And I think that's going to involve some training and things like that, which I'll come back to. But PI-led science has kind of been a hallmark of the scientific success of the Mars Exploration Program. Slide 9, I come back and beat on mobility again, but just demonstrating that, or by pointing out, for example, Spirit and Opportunity, supposed to be able to go, 500 or 600 meters, and now Opportunity has driven more than a marathon's worth of distance on Mars. Spirit ended up going 6 or 7 kilometers, I believe. Being able to take that platform with those kinds of instruments investigations on them to large distances to sample the diversity of terrain was absolutely essential for Spirit's mission. Spirit, the results from Spirit and the legacy of Spirit would be entirely different if that vehicle had not had the longevity and mobility to eventually arrive at home plate in the southern basin of the Columbia Hills and discover evidence for ancient habitability many years into that mission. Opportunity was more lucky. We kind of landed right where the habitability story happened to be, and the whole area has turned out to be incredibly interesting. But we've been able to dig deeper figuratively into the Martian past by using the mobility to travel from one crater to another, larger and larger crater, sampling deeper into the Martian subsurface and deeper into the Martian past. So that kind of mobility has been absolutely essential, but also throttled by the reality of latency, the reality of only being able to communicate with the vehicle once per day, by the reality of the limitations in computational power for these kinds of vehicles to make their own decisions about navigation, about obstacle avoidance, hazard avoidance, target selection, et cetera, et cetera. I can imagine these kinds of vehicles on the surface. In fact, before heading down the path of Curiosity class rovers, there were a number of us in the community talking about sort of a cluster bomb of MERS-sized rovers being sent to the planet. I can imagine these class of, and size of vehicles being used in a very different way if they could be more actively controlled under much lower latency situations. The heritage of the instruments could be similarly high and reliable. The systems could leverage the longevity that's been designed into these systems by JPL and others. But I think the science would be dramatically more voluminous and perhaps even more compelling if they could be controlled much closer to real time. I'll come back to that a little bit near the end. Let's go to slide 10. And just point out that in addition to sort of XY access on the surface, it's been critical to have some subsurface access. The way Phoenix got its subsurface access was through the arm and the scoop, and of course making the discovery, validating the remote sensing, finding the ice in the shallow subsurface that had been predicted by the Mars Odyssey neutron and gamma ray spectrometer results. A wonderful demonstration of the robustness of the remote sensing there, and able to be validated at the surface because of that subsurface access. On slide 11, I point out that we've been able to use this mobility not just in XY again, but in T or time with Curiosity and to a lesser extent Spirit and Opportunity, but Curiosity is all about climbing through this stack of sedimentary layers that start down at the bottom in ancient Mars and go up. I mean, if we could actually get all the way to the top of Mount Sharp, there's dust falling on the surface today, so it's a stack of sediments that spans almost the entire range of Martian history. And so the mobility is being used not just to sample laterally different kinds of outcrops, rocks and soils and sands, but vertically in time, geologic time on Mars by climbing through these different layers. So applying that mobility again in a constrained way because of the latency we often run into, at least one one day latency, sometimes more, depending upon, you know, weekends, holidays, anomalies on the vehicle, issues with the DSM, et cetera. So, again, it's a great situation to be in to have an asset like this on the surface, but all of us do feel the sort of limitations, the real limitations that are imposed upon us by that, by the reality of long latency. Slide 12 just adds the fact that the Curiosity gives us the X, Y, and time, and also the Z dimension as well, like we saw with the Phoenix scoop. Curiosity can drill into the surface. It's a small drill hole. It's pinky-sized, but they are the best drill holes that we've made on Mars yet. So, despite the latency, despite the limitations placed on us by the distance and time lag, we've now got more than a dozen holes drilled, and the team in the last year especially has just gotten really good at increasing the efficiency of drilling. What used to be a many-week process of checking out systems, oftentimes with ground in the loop necessary over a day, has become much more, I won't say routine, but much more streamlined as people have gotten good at this. And so drilling now is down to a week or less kind of an activity, which is still a lot of time to drill a relatively small hole in the ground. But you can see already in some of the early drill holes in the upper left there that it's been dramatic. I mean, red Mars becomes gray Mars when you drill just below the surface. And in the case of even just the first few drill holes, the enormous amount of clay minerals that were detected, water-bearing clay minerals, very surprising because the remote sensing only sees the dust on the surface in these areas. So having that mobility in the Z-axis, absolutely essential to the success of Curiosity so far, being able to bring that material inside an organic chemistry lab, inside an X-ray diffraction lab. It's a motivator for me to come into work every day, especially after drilling, and knowing that that stuff that we just put in the organic chemistry lab could change the world. It hasn't happened yet, and we haven't seen any, super dramatic evidence of organics, small amount of intrinsic organics that might be related to meteorite influx or some modifications in the Martian atmosphere because of the effect of UV. But just to be in a situation to make those measurements is just a real amazing thing and a great success of the program. But it takes a long time. Again, it's a week to drill a hole. I try not to dwell on, how much more efficient it would be, how many more holes we could drill, how much better we could sample the stratigraphy if we were in fact controlling a capability like this and something much closer to real time instead of with these very long latency drag times. So slide 13, robotic exploration is human exploration. All of these things that are happening are not happening in an automated way on the vehicle, right? There's a big misconception out there, partly propagated by us, partly by the media, to the general public, that the robots are exploring Mars, that Opportunity discovered X or Curiosity discovered Y. Of course, the reality is there's a big team of people, 300 to 500 scientists, thousands of engineers around the country, around the world, involved in making these things happen. And every major decision that's made, whether it's a drive decision or a drill decision or some decision about how to deploy certain consumables, certain situations, those are all human decisions. And they're made by a large group that also can add latency to many of these problems as well. Just the act of having to get a group of scientists to agree to come to consensus, there's a latency in that process as well, even though we struggle with trying to make that as quickly as possible. So that's sort of the background for that first point. Slide 14, here's some bling from the science world of Mars rovers, right? Covers of Science Magazine, many others. Robotic exploration obviously is enabling amazing science, despite the frustrations having to do with the latency, despite the slow motion nature of this kind of exploration, the science has been absolutely compelling, first rate, and continues to motivate us for these missions and future missions. In slide 15, the graphics there are meant to make the point that those same missions, those same investigations, processes are also helping to enable human exploration, right? I talked about global geologic context, needing to know the topography and the details of potential landing sites in terms of hazards and obstacle avoidance, needing to understand where these potential special zones might be, either to avoid in some people's perspective or to aim for in other people's perspective, places where liquid water may have been recently near the surface, understanding the radiation environment, of course, understanding the EDL conditions, what's the atmosphere like, and what challenges will a time variable atmosphere like Mars's place on entry vehicles, robotic and piloted, certain details of the meteorology, the current weather of Mars. We talk about understanding the past climate of Mars, but missions like MRO and the MARSI camera and the wide-angle MOC camera on MGS before it, acting as our weather satellites and revealing what is, on the one hand, a phenomenally repeatable cycle of local and regional dust storm activity, to the point where some of my colleagues can tell you a year in advance where the dust storms will be at specific places on Mars. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's also the same kind of environment that spawns these dramatic global dust storms, and we don't understand how that happens or why that happens and why it's sporadic. So understanding the cycle of meteorology on Mars is going to be critical for future human explorers as well. The map of the hydrogen in the lower right from Mars Odyssey, looking at the resource potential, and then experiments like the MOXIE that will happen on Mars 2020 to just demonstrate ISRU capabilities in situ. Maybe not, the most complex chemistry, but, getting that all into a miniaturized instrument, operating it remotely, demonstrating chemical extraction of oxygen or water or other volatiles. Very valuable thing to do to build up experience. So I like the fact, I really am a big fan of the fact of the human HEOMD and SMD and STMD working together to make sure that whatever missions go there and whatever they're doing, that there's some aspect of thinking into the future for how can we leverage what this spacecraft is going to do or what it's capable of or what it can carry for future human exploration. I think that's a great thing. Number 16, coming to my final point, latency is it's a complex thing, right? And we really need to study this carefully. Here's a quote from Steve Squire's book. The unfortunate truth is that most things our rovers can do in a perfect sol, a human explorer could do in less than a minute. And here he is explaining that to the governator at the landing of Spirit 2004. My friend Steve and I differ a little bit in our viewpoint on this. I don't think it's a minute. I think these rovers are doing a lot of things in the field that we wouldn't do in the field, or that our graduate students wouldn't do in the field, collecting samples, bringing them back to the laboratory, and doing the kinds of measurements that are happening on some of these vehicles is a many weeks to months process, actually. His point is still valid, though. Okay, people in that environment with this equipment could do the job much faster. They would have more mobility. They would have more flexibility in terms of that mobility, and they'd have the ability to make decisions very quickly on the ground. So the point is well taken, although Steve and I may argue in some detail about the specific time scales. excuse me, slide 17 then, just a nice collection of NASA art, thinking about the low latency situation when we do get humans down onto the surface environment, and go to slide 18, and much of this I'm sure is familiar to this audience, the ability of people to use the human brain to make quick decisions, unique capabilities, fine motor skills, spatial pattern recognition skills for construction and repair, the ability to adapt quickly and flexibly to a variety of situations, anomalies or opportunities, and just the experience-based and opportunistic decision-making ability of a trained and experienced human observer slash scientist out in that environment, especially for, in my experience, especially for fields like geology, where it is essentially a forensic science, where you're essentially being a detective trying to solve a crime. What happened here? You get scraps and shreds of evidence from long ago, and the pieces need to be put together into a puzzle. And you can't write a program. There is no algorithm that describes how to answer the question, how to solve the crime. Instead, it's a combination of experience in the field on the Earth, observations in the field on Mars or other planets, and completely intangible things like gut instinct and best guess, and, you know, multiple working hypotheses, and all of these skills and experiences that that field geologists on our planet use all the time. And still, they crawl around the planet and argue about the interpretations. Certainly is going to be the case on Mars as well. But all of these skills can be brought to bear on a place like Mars, the moon, asteroids, wherever we send people, in the same way that, that they're brought to bear every day in the field exploration of our own planet.
Jim, got a question. This is Harley. Got a question about this issue. And of course, we've all heard, all the folks on here have heard Steve Squire's comment about the rapidity, the advantage that humans on site would have over the rovers, for example, and probably have had similar disagreements that you cited about yourself in here. But basically, humans are a whole lot faster than the robots that we have now or likely to have any time in the future. However, is there also, and I don't want to quite put, I'll use a somewhat pejorative term, is there on, in addition to humans, is there a drag on humans on site by also, just as the robots have now, of having a few hundred person back room back home, so that as the humans, hypothetically on the surface of Mars, are finding this interesting rock, looking under that interesting rock, picking us, chipping away at this, these little drills, there will be, nevertheless, humans back home saying, oh, wait a second, Jane, not go too fast. Wait a second. Pick this thing. Wait. You've got to go back to where you were before. You all, I don't. I'm a simple astronomer. You guys must have that kind of discussion that humans will really not be that much faster than the robots.
That is a great comment, Harley. I'm not going to answer it because it's coming up. We're going to talk about this in a few slides.
Okay.
It sort of gets to this creativity versus determinism issue that you're right, that could completely crush any potential advantage you might have in terms of latency if it's not carefully managed. That's a great point and a great lead in to a couple of slides from now. So hold that thought.
Okay. Sounds good.
All right. Let's go to slide 19. And this is just, continuing to make my point that the latency issue is complex because on the one hand, there's, a couple hundred scientists out there doing Mars surface ops every day, supported by hundreds of engineers and managers and technologists and administrators and all that. And we're all frustrated at how slow it goes. And so latency is tough to deal with. But on the other hand, it's so much better than the alternative, which is not having anything on the surface at all. And so what I'll come back to is that in the effort to manage latency, we have to always think about value and compare the cost benefit of reducing latency versus the cost benefit of the science that we can do in the sort of quote unquote usual way by accepting long latency. So it's just something to always keep on the table, and it's part of the complexity of the argument. I'll come back to that in a moment. I've just got a couple of slides that, slide 20, getting to the issue that Harley started to bring up. You know, we've got this great experience now from Apollo. Here's Ed Mitchell in Apollo 14. He's reading his map, trying to get to the rim of Cone Crater. And as Harley said, there's a large crew of people back in Houston and elsewhere around the country who are his backroom team, helping him out, trying to guide into the right place. Of course, he's using his observations in real time to make instant decisions, and then a large group of people who are questioning his decisions and trying to think about his next move the whole time. Slide 21, just a nice shot of Charlie Duke on 16. Again, following the mission profile, taking advantage of what he, from his training, knew was a request from the back room, hey, look for a place where material could be scooped up and sampled that's been shielded from the sun or from radiation in general, under a rock in a shadowed area, et cetera. Had to use his own, you know, low latency observational experience to find that place, but knew that there's this sort of longstanding mission goal to try to find a piece of or a sample from a place that had been more protected, less exposed to the solar wind and other environmental effects. 22. I heard John on the line. Here's a nice picture of John and Andrew on HST on 125 in May 2009, helping to repair HST. Okay, they're obviously in a low latency situation, making judgment calls on their own. Can I get this screw out? Do I need to deal with a different kind of tool in this situation? Unanticipated. But at the same time, they've got this back room and a script that they're being asked to follow, which on some level, and maybe, you know, John should comment on this, must have been oppressive at some level, but at another level was probably also somehow satisfying in that you know you have all this backup, people watching your back and helping you make all these plans. But so again, there's a tension there. There's a tension between having the help of the back room, having the overseers and overlords, and the scripted nature of much of what happened on shuttle and ISS, and to maybe a lesser extent on Apollo, and the desire of, you know, human beings to make creative, independent decisions and be flexible in response to the reality on the ground or in the air. And then the last one of these examples in slide 23 from 17, where Cernan and Schmidt, you know, they had to repair the fender on the rover, a little bit of improvisation. And then scientifically, one of the coolest science results to come out of 17 was Schmidt's discovery of the orange soil, which turned out to be these spectacular iron-bearing pyroclastic beads, and all these discoveries since then coming out of the analysis of these samples about volatiles in the moon and the fact that the moon does have a volatile inventory. I mean, really great stuff, but it was his training as a geologist and, you know, training leading up to the mission by the back room, people like Gene Shoemaker and others, say, keep an eye out for these things, keep an eye out for those things, and then being able to respond flexibly and quickly when an observation is made that supports a mission goal. You know, I brought all this up, I'm going to slide 24 now, I brought all this up at the H2M conference, and during the Q&A session, my friend and colleague Jim Head got up and said, hey, you know, you really should look at some studies that have been done in more detail on this, and so he pointed me to this paper, which I just include the first page in the abstract. So, you know, a Russian group looking at their own mission operations scenarios and their own issues of latency and casting it in terms of this, I think, is really interesting psychological, psychiatric kind of way to think about, you know, are you utilizing the creativity that is intrinsic to these individuals, highly trained, highly professional, highly educated, creative people, or is that being wasted by the determinism of the script or the oppression of the back room or what have you? So they've looked at this in some of their own ISS crew activities and they point out, you know, some of the concerns of having a culture of operations, human operations, that is used to the back room playing a major role, but putting people from that culture in a situation out maybe far beyond the moon and asteroids or Mars, where latency prevents that culture from operating efficiently. And so I think I encourage people to read articles like this, and, you know, there's some others in the reference list here, and just familiarize yourself with some of the real world, real space world examples of this complex topic. 25 just points out, and we talked about this at H2M as well, that the Planetary Society had helped promote this study with JPL and others about humans orbiting Mars as a great first step, and maybe the most logical first step in exploration of the red planet. And so part of that study, and I encourage you to go to the, if you just Google humans orbiting Mars, Planetary Society, you'll find the report and the webpage. Part of this study was thinking about the kinds of science and exploration and technology development that could be done from a remote outpost in orbit around Mars, or sitting on Phobos or Deimos and helping to control or operate assets on the surface. Deimos especially is particularly interesting just because of the way that it orbits so slowly around Mars and lines up with certain features for many weeks in a row, effectively. So lots of potential for telerobotics and low latency, much lower latency than we're used to have an influence on future human exploration. Being able to run, I talked about this earlier, being able to, you know, run a MER class or Curiosity class rover to do drilling activities where ground in the loop is a 10-minute process instead of a 24-hour process, could, you know, dramatically increase the amount of exploration, the number of scientific discoveries that could potentially be made. And so I encourage you, if you haven't seen that report, check that out. And kind of interesting to see Lockheed, of course, follow up on that with some of their own ideas more recently. So pretty cool stuff. Last couple of slides here, 26 then, you know, how do we best use our experience with long latency robotics to deploy low latency for telerobotics? I'm not going to answer that question, but I think there's lots of experience and lessons learned from the robotic community that can go into a sort of consensus response that with some detailed study by our community. 27, just come back to that issue of drill holes. Here's the collection of the first dozen drill holes, and that many, many, many weeks process earlier on, gotten down to about a week process now. So we are exploring faster and more frequently because of lessons learned, but we're still going to be fundamentally limited by the need for ground in the loop at critical decision points. 28 shows an example of, on the top is Spirit, and on the bottom is Opportunity, getting stuck in some deep sand, deep fine-grained sand deposits, a situation where if we'd been able to be much more active in terms of remote sensing of the terrain nearby, probably in both of these situations, these hazards would have been recognized much more quickly than they were. In the case of the Opportunity hazard at the bottom, that sand, very fine-grained sand, was 20 centimeters or so thick, and it took 3 weeks of spinning the wheels when the rover got out. In the case of Spirit, the sandy deposits were even thicker, and that's where the rover is today. Ultimately, it was contributed to the end of the mission by not being able to get unbogged from this unanticipated sand deposit that might have been, maybe have been recognized if we'd had much more in the human in the loop assessment capability of the terrain around us. 29 just shows a nice example of some automation. I said, you know, the rovers aren't making automated decisions generally, but there are tests that have been done, special cases, and, you know, obstacle avoidance. You see the rover was looking for obstacles, avoided the little crater at the top, diverted around it as part of the exploration along the rim of Victoria Crater. So the technology is improving to build in better capability for onboard, you know, machine learning kind of ways to decrease latency, even in intrinsically long latency robotic missions. So that is improving, and the expectation is that things will be better on 2020 than they were on MSL, et cetera, et cetera. But we're still going to be limited by computational speed. And slide 30, which was an animation, just show a screenshot of it here, of Endurance Crater, just demonstrates that, you know, in fact, there are many situations where we're approaching 90-degree cliffs and steep obstacles where we still often, almost always, don't have the guts to turn on the automation on the vehicles. It really is still when we get close to something really dangerous like this, it's going to be joysticked, in quotes, with the built-in long latency. And so an enormous amount of conservatism, and the rates of travel around obstacles like this become very, very, very slow. Slide 31, just some summary bullets, important drivers of thinking about how to optimize low latency for robotic exploration from Mars orbit. What is the added science or exploration value that those kind of telerobotic operations would provide? Given the risk, you're putting crew in this risky environment, can we demonstrate that it is worthy of that risk because of the, specifically the kinds of increased science capabilities, increased capabilities for mobility, et cetera? So just making that demonstration, I think, is an important thing for us to do. And we could make some good predictions of that, I think, even starting relatively soon. So what are the attributes that low latency provides that make it worth that risk versus just living with the current delay? And we're doing a lot with this current delay situation. Everyone knows we could do more, but will we pass that threshold of doing more? Can we pass that threshold that makes it worth, at least for this part of it, makes it worth the risk that the crew is taking? And if not, if we don't think we can pass that threshold with our current technology or capabilities, what are the innovations that could allow us to jump over that barrier? Computational speed, specific algorithms, technology development, instrument development. What are the kinds of advances or innovations that could provide that additional value? And that'll help us focus on the kinds of development that might be most beneficial in the near future. So then 32 is my last slide, just my three main points again. I hope I've beat some of them to the ground successfully. Robotic exploration is human exploration. It enables science and human exploration. And that latency is a complex issue, needs careful study, and I think there are some really good lessons that can come out of our robotics experience as we go forward. So that's it. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Jim. This is Harley. I've got a number of questions, and maybe what I'd like to do, if John Grunsfeld, if you're still on the line, I wonder if you could, your experience was very different, of course, than what we expect Mars exploration of the surface with humans, but do you want to make a few comments about, quote-unquote, the back room, its advantages and disadvantages when you were doing Hubble servicing? Again, if you're still on the line.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks, Harley. I unmuted my mic about 10 times during that short intercourse between you and Jim. And Jim and I have talked about this before. The latency question is one slice through the many issues about exploring Mars. And, I think the folks on Mars 2020 are making great strides in trying to make the rover more efficient. And one of those is, we're looking at putting a drone associated with the helicopter to do better mapping. And so the rover can be more efficient in where it drives, but it still comes down to, making the decisions about where to drive, where to drill, what's the geologic context and the risk and the reward of investigating, a particular site. And that's what's done on Earth today. And so that's, that takes a long time. There are tools, a lot of good tools that'll make that a lot quicker in the back room. But when you're at Mars, just the light travel time means, that at best, if you made an instant decision, the rover's not going to know about it from 20 minutes to an hour later. And so the advantage of low latency in principle is if you had people in orbit, they could make those decisions and then it's, a few minutes later. However, it all depends on the people you have in orbit. And so I think taking advantage of low latency only works if you actually have geologists and astrobiologists at Mars and experienced and seasoned people who've had a lot of not just training, but have gone out and done, field geology, who are true experts in the field. And I think that's really crucial that as we go beyond low Earth orbit, to explore Mars specifically, that we send people who are experts in Mars. You know, I think Charlie Duke and John Young on Apollo 16 did a great job. You know, Jim Head was one of their trainers, and feels like they learned a lot. But they did have the back room, and they only had, you know, a couple of minutes of latency, and they were in comm constantly because they were on the Earth-facing side of the moon. You know, I felt like Drew and I on Hubble had enough knowledge about the Hubble for the tests we were doing that even though we were highly scripted, you know, on the EVA-3, for instance, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. But as an experimental astrophysicist who'd worked on instruments and had a lot of experience, you know, it was sort of normal ops for me. It was not off nominal. If I had had to stop and ask every time, you know, a screw didn't come out, you know, we never would have gotten it done. And so I think that if you're going to bring the human experience to Mars, it has to be the right experience. Otherwise, you're going to get trapped in the same old, you know, anytime something looks different or anytime an important decision needs to be made, it's going to be a call back to Earth and a 24-hour turnaround. That said, the model of how we do space exploration has to change. You know, all these hundreds of people on the ground want to be intimately involved in every detail. And so we need people to let go a little bit and give the folks who are there, either in orbit or on the surface, you know, the freedom to explore the way people explore. So I think I'll stop there.
Okay, John, great. Thanks. Do folks have other comments? Or folks have had similar, well, very few folks have had similar experience with John as John did, or have the kind of knowledge that Jim has. Do folks have other questions?
Yeah, Jim, this is Dan Lester. Let me bring up a couple of questions. This is a really good talk. Thank you very much. I wanted to drop back to your slide 31, your list of important drivers, which I think is a wonderful summary of the issues that have to be confronted in this. And I just want to direct your attention to that first bullet. Is there added science and or exploration value that telerobotic operations from Mars orbit provides, given the risks that the crew will be exposed to? I was a little surprised about this because this isn't just about telerobotic operations from Mars orbit. It's about boots on the ground as well. You can ask exactly the same question about boots on the ground, and it's a good question to ask. So let me just suggest that the real question is what humans that are close enough to Mars to have real-time involvement, what value that actually provides to science. Does that make sense to you? Or?
It does. No, and I agree with you, Dan. I think that, you know, of course, it's already all crazy risky, and you just increase that risk when you want to get them to the surface and take them back off the surface, okay? So it's only becoming more risky with boots on the ground.
Yep.
So it's sort of different levels, but no, I completely agree. And you know, I was maybe hinting at one, you know, axis of the answer that I would focus on, and that is the ability to operate what is, you know, relatively complex machinery that requires a lot of ground-in-the-loop checking, a drill, much more frequently. You know, if we could drill 10 samples in the location that we're studying instead of one in a tenth of the time, I mean, you're talking about, you know, really being able to do statistically robust assessments of chemistry, mineralogy, geology in a way that we're just not able to do with the kinds of latency that we have now. So
that's great. Let me bring up one more thing. I know you're rushed for time here, and I want to quite do this quickly, but I think it was really fascinating, the question that Harley asked about, you know, the science back room and the involvement of the back room, and what kind of involvement would you have if you had individuals either on the surface of Mars or in orbit around Mars. And John built on this somewhat as well in his remarks. But, you know, what this really strikes me as is different flavors of science activity. On the one hand, done by individuals in real time, which is exactly what terrestrial field geologists do, or on the other hand, done by committee over long time delays. And I'm not saying one kind of science is better than the other. I think they both have different advantages, but they're different. It's just a different kind, a different way of doing science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I mean, I think John's point is the right one. It's the same one made by the Russian authors of that abstract I showed. The back room has to, on one level, learn how to let go. And that letting go has to come from the trust that they build up in the crew during the training activity prior to launch. And the trust that they have in the crew, you know, during cruise, that they're staying on the tips of their toes and learning new things along the way, responding to discoveries being made prior to their arrival, all that kind of stuff. But I think it comes down to trust and training and, you know, the skill of the people chosen and all the same points that John made.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Julio Lars. I'd like to revisit for a second this whole matter, because on the matter of navigation, rovers are obviously capable of avoiding potholes, and they will be much better in the future. I think there is no question. I mean, the Google Mobile will teach a lesson to everybody. Now, as far as science, there are two things, it seems to me. On one hand, there is the fact that Mars, the Moon, or anything else really do not change very much in hours, weeks, or even years, except perhaps for the storms and so on and so forth. But basically, the situation is what it is. Another hit or two do not really make sense. On the other hand, there is the matter of the back room team and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that this is rather important, because the back room is not just taking time, but they are really doing a lot of calculation, a lot of modeling, a lot of comparison of data before and after and so on and so forth. And the issue, it seems to me, boils down to whether it's preferable to do sort of a gut science, in the sense, you know, do an observation because your gut tells you that that's the right thing to do, or whether it's better to do a rather thoughtful construction of what the possibilities are, what the probabilities are, what we know, what we should know, models, and so on and so forth. I think we are past beyond the fact that science was done by watching the apple fall from the tree. Now it's a matter of making a lot of careful measurements at different wavelengths, different all kinds of things, and then trying to coordinate all that. Now, that takes time. So the question is whether it's better to do a smart decision that may take a few hours or even days, rather than a gut decision and possibly a dumb decision immediately, especially considering the last point made, that the cost of making the immediate decision is at least an order of magnitude and often two orders of magnitude greater than the human, because of the human mission. And furthermore, there is a real risk of that humans will die in favor of such a quick guts decision. So it seems to me that in a way the issue is simpler than it seems, although, you know, there are other complicated matters. But the risk to human lives has to be factored in more seriously than we've done so far. And secondly, I think one should not discount the value added by the backroom team, because they really provide the consensus of the community of PIs and so on that you mentioned at the beginning of the talk, which really produces the valuable results, rather than a quick decision and say, let's punch another hole.
Yeah. You know, those are great points. I would just say that in my opinion, there's no simple solution. And, you know, in one sense, the latency, the ground in the loop need for at least one sol and sometimes many more sols latency in current robotic exploration of Mars gives us a luxury of being able to have time to think about processing what we do next. And that would
like
be different if we took that
5 minutes or taking a month to do it. I don't
yeah.
know which one.
it's going to be very, very situationally dependent. Much more so than it is now.
Thank you.
Got about one more minute, if Tim can last until the top of the hour. One more quick question.
Hey, this is Hoppy at JPL, and I think one of the areas where astronaut-robot synergy will be really important will be exploring these extreme terrain areas of special interest, because, number one, astronauts probably aren't going to be able to go there for planetary protection reasons, but also it'll be difficult to automate rovers negotiating down, you know, if you're rappelling down rocky cliffs or going in caves. I think having the humans there in real time just to drive it to where you want to go may actually be enabling for those kind of explorations.
Oh, totally. I completely agree. And, you know, every chance I get at public talks or conferences to dispel this myth of humans versus robots, I take the chance to dispel the myth, because it's not like we're going to go instead of the robots. No, we're going to go and we're going to use our robotic friends and emissaries as tools to the greatest advantage of the problems and questions we're trying to tackle. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Jim, do you have 30 seconds more if somebody has a question?
Yeah, I can stick around for 2 more minutes.
Okay, quick question.
I have a quick question. This is Mitch Cross.
Also at JPL. I thought that I was interested to hear you say Demos was maybe favorable as a place. To me, the big discriminator between Demos and Phobos is the latency. That is a very complicated question. And from what I've heard, the latency at Demos would make telerobotics very arduous. Do you know anything about that, or can you?
Well, I don't remember what I said exactly, but what I meant was that it's a different situation between Phobos and Deimos. At Phobos, you're passing over every surface area very quickly, almost like a comm orbiter, a little slower than that, but passing over very quickly, and so you can do a small number of things, interactions in quote-unquote real time with the vehicle, whereas with Deimos, you're parked over these areas for days and days and days at a time as it slowly moves underneath the satellite. And so you have the opportunity to interact with surface assets for a much longer period of time, at, of course, a slightly longer latency than at Phobos, but not dramatically longer, in my opinion.
It actually is. I'll follow up with an email.
Great.
Yeah, I'm amazed that's a big latency. You're talking a tenth of a second round-trip latency to Deimos to the surface.
No, it's more than that. Figure everything in.
It's 20,000 kilometers one way.
No, it's more than a tenth just for the lifetime.
But
it's all equipment.
But it's a very small number compared to like Earth, Moon, or, you know.
Oh, yeah. But robotics experiments where they've had that kind of quarter second latency in there have shown that it's very hard.
This is Josh Hopkins. We did a paper several years ago comparing Deimos and Phobos for telerobotics, and I'd be happy to send it to anybody who is interested.
Great.
Sure, I would be.
We've also done a lot of work. Dan Lust and I have talked about this, up to 5 seconds latency doing precision work, and you can train to that.
Hey, Harley, I do have to run off. Got another.
Thank you all. Great questions. Thank you, Jim. Bye bye now, guys.
The rovers don't care about our schedules, they demand us their attention. Thank you.